It's funny. I ended up in North Carolina, and I went by the beach house, and I just talked to Dad, and we just talked. And I said to him, I said, you know, Dad, he said, how's the job going, son? I said, well, I said, it's going well, but I'm miserable. And he said, you are? And I said, yeah. He said, you know, the thing that strikes me, since you started hanging out with those people, that's you, since you started hanging out with those people, your life has worked very well, and you've been happy. He said, I'm surprised to hear you're not happy. He said, why do you think you're not happy? And I said, well, I said, Dad, I think I thought success was getting a higher position and not doing more of what made me happy. And he said, boy, those people have taught you a lot. He said, you're a success. He said, you've gone further than I ever dreamt of going. And he said, I'm very proud of you. And he said, why don't you do what makes you happy? And I was amazed. And I said to him, I said, you know, Dad, I really owe you an amends. I said, I must have worried you sick when I was drunk and I was disappearing and on and on. And he said, oh, yeah, yeah, he said. He said, and then he told me a story which made me know why I owed him an amends. He said, remember when you went to work, your first real job? And I said, yeah. I said, I was 13 years old. And I said, I got a job setting pins in the bowling alley down in Bridgeport. He said, yeah. He said, you remember your first day at work? And I said, no, I don't think I do. He said, well, he said, I took you to lunch. He said, we went to Louis' hot dog stand. Don't you remember? And I said, no, I don't. And he said, you remember what you had for lunch? And I said, I'm going to go out on a limb, Dad. Did I have a hot dog? And he said, of course you had a hot dog, you loon. He used to call me a loon. You damn loon. Of course you had a hot dog. He said, do you remember what you drank? I said, I guess I drank an orange pop. I always drank orange pop. And he said, not that day. He said, that day you drank a root beer. He said, I always drank root beer, and I think you thought men who worked drank root beer. And he said, and I explained to you about you know, doing a good day's work for a good day's pay, and that you owe your boss respect, and your boss owes you respect. And he said, I explained it all to you, and we walked down to the bus stop, and I had to go to the next town. And he said, we got down to the bus stop, and he said, I was so afraid for you. He said, you were a puny little thing. And he said, you started on the bus, and I said, son, you want me to come down with you on the first day? And you said, no thanks, Dad, I'll do it myself. And he said, I watched the bus until it was out of sight, and you never looked back. And I thought, what would I have done? That would have destroyed me. And then he gave me the key to the whole thing. He said, you know, he said, from that day on, I never felt as though I could ever tell you anything because you never let me do anything for you. You know, I was the oldest son in a large, poor family. I thought I was supposed to take care of myself. But the reason I owed my father amends is because I never let my father do what he did best, which was be a father. I robbed him of the opportunity to father me, because I thought I was doing what was right. And he said, you know, your brothers and sisters let me help them go to college and everything. And you never needed my help. You did it all yourself. He said, I'm proud of you. I said, I'm not. He said, I'm not proud of me. I said, I missed the best part of you, Dad. Well, we're both pretty young, you know. I said, yeah, we are. You know, a couple days later, I needed to borrow a couple $1,000 from him. And I did, and then I paid him back in a few weeks, and from then on we've been very, very close, because he's my father and he fathered me. This step works miracles. It works magic. And you know, once I straighten it out with my father, I could straighten it out with God. I could straighten it out with men in authority. I could straighten it all out. The key for me was that critical relationship. And that allowed me to be a father. You know, I had been practicing something for some years sober before this time. I was sober about 12, 13 years when this happened. And I'd been practicing something at the suggestion of my sponsor. And that was, I was honoring my parents. And by honoring them, I meant I stopped correcting them. They had lived a long time and done fairly well, and they probably didn't need my input. And I stopped arguing with them about things, and they'd say something, and I remember one time I was having a discussion with my dad. Well, we were sitting there just sort of rocking and looking out at the ocean, and he said, you know what the problem is? I said, no, Dad. He said, the problem's computers. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, when I worked at the pipe coupling, he worked in a factory where they made couplings to put pipes together. He said, there were two guys in the warehouse. Their names, believe it or not, were Bert and Ernie. They were, I didn't laugh, he said, Bert and Ernie, he said, they always knew what we had. He said, they always knew. He said, if somebody said, we need 5,000 3/8 inch couplings, Bert and Ernie knew if we had them. He said, then we got computers. He said, computers had to punch holes in those cards. Well, they hadn't punched holes in cards and computers for 20 years, but I kept my mouth shut. That's not important. There was a time I'd have said, that's dumb, Dad. And I'd have tried to belittle him, and I just said, yeah. And he said, if you punch a hole in the wrong place in that card, it doesn't tell you. It tells you have couplings you don't have. I said, really? He said, yeah. And then you have to shut down the whole factory, and you have to retool the line to make the couplings that you need. He said, yeah, I think the problem's computers. And I said, Dad, I never really looked at it that way before. And I didn't correct him. I didn't do anything. I just agreed with him, and that's honoring him. And I had done that for a number of years. I had practiced honoring my parents. And, the big book says that that to honor your parents is the commandment with promise. And a promise is long life. And I don't think it necessarily means that you live a long time. But once I was able to honor my parents, once I was able to make amends to my parents, once I was able to straighten that out with them, then I was able to understand and get along with my own children much, much better. And that's long life. Long life is having peace with your parents and peace with your children. That's long life. And that's what that offered me. That was a critical, critical thing for me. And what I mainly discovered was that my father was a very frightened man. When he ran around, he was foreman of the month for so many months, because he's so particular about how he does things. He was foreman of the month for so many months that they did away with the award. It was bad for morale. And yet, one day he overslept, and he was sure they were going to fire him. And he was running around saying to my mother, I hope you're satisfied. I'm going to get fired. We're going to starve to death. We're going to go to the poorhouse. And it was frantic. And I realized what courage he must have had to live his whole life with this kind of fear. He had alcoholic parents too. And they lost everything. And what kind of courage he must have to live his whole life in this kind of terror and still be the father he was and the husband he was. And how he defined things as right and wrong and how important family is. And I'll never forget this. My mother told me this story which told me what I need to know about my father. My mother didn't have a birth certificate, and when she was 62 or 63, she was going to start collecting Social Security, but she didn't have a birth certificate, and she couldn't prove who she was. And so she got my father and his sister to go, and his sister testified that she was who she said she was. And this public servant said, well, ma'am, this is all very good, but I don't know who you are, really. And my father stepped up. He said, sir, she's my wife. And ended the conversation. That's what I want to be. That's what I want to be. And he taught me how to be that. And because I cut him out of my life, it took me a long time to learn it. Critical amends. And then it was Dumb Denny. And if you have a brother or sister like Dumb Denny, you know what I mean. They do it once. They do everything once. Make you crazy. And they just stay with the same company for 27 years or 28 years, and they go up the ladder. Boring consistency. And then there's me, who's doing it differently. And I knew I owed Denny an amends. And the reason I owed him an amends is I prayed about it and wrote little things on that card. Was because of I had done something called detraction. I was so threatened by how well he did life that every chance I got to say something negative about him in front of the family, I did. And I recognized that that's how I dealt with his success, by trying to make him look like less in other people's eyes. And so I did the opposite. For 6 months, with my sponsor's guidance, I began the process of saying and repeating to them all the wonderful things about him, which were all true, and saying I'm really proud of him, and boy, isn't he doing well, and I would give specific site-specific examples of what he had done and what he had done well. So I did all this before I went to him. And I got in a car, and I drove to New Jersey, and we sat down and began to have a talk, and his wife Jan knew that this was a different kind of a talk, and she excused herself and went to bed. And I was able to talk to him about why I owed him an amends and the things I had done. And I said, I admire you as much as any man in the world. And I said, what I was I envied you. And I envied your success, and I envied your tenacity, and I envied your ability to stay with it. And I said, for the last 6 months, this is what I've done. And I explained it to him. And I said, and I stand ready to do anything else I can do to fix this relationship, because I would love it to be the way it was. And he said to me, he said, I'd give anything to have that back. And he said, so if you owe me an amends, and I owe you an amends too. And I said, really? He said, I've always envied you. He said, all my life I've been afraid. He said, I'm afraid to drop out of school. I'm afraid to change. He said, I'm afraid to do anything. And he said, I used to look at you, and he said, you didn't seem to give a shit about anything. He said, if things weren't going well in one country, you'd go to another country. He said, nothing seemed to stop you. He said, you went to Skid Row, you lost everything, and you came back. And he said, I admire you more than anybody I know. And I would give anything if I could have the kind of intestinal fortitude and strength that you have. And I discovered it. We weren't good and bad, we were just different. We were just different. We just dealt with life differently. And that's what makes our friendship so important to me today, is we discuss things. And I love his perspective on things. I'm just going to make an investment, and I called him up, and I, emailed him a bunch of stuff, and he looked it all over, and he gave me his judgment on things. And then he's looking at going on the board of a company. He's retired now, and they always after him to go on boards. And he emailed me some stuff, and I read that, and he wanted to know my opinion on that. But mostly he wants to know my opinion on things like right and wrong. Can you imagine that? What's the best way to do this? What would be most right? And we talk about things like Aquinas and, what's most right and what's most noble and what's most loving. What's the best way I can handle this? He asked me, how can you help me? Can you give me some suggestions so I stop being critical of my wife? And I said, yeah. I said, the same person who's making all these mistakes loves you. He said, damn, that's a good way to start. But the important thing is what we have back is a relationship, and we have it back directly as a result of the ninth step. I went and did a ninth step with God. Went to that back to that same chapel, and I sat down, and I made amends. And I said, I know you've forgiven me because that's the way you're wired. And I said, but I want you to know that I recognize, what I've done, and that I'm the one that moved, and I just want to thank you for sticking around. And, he said he'd always be there, and I believe he'll always be there. I believe that at the bottom of my heart. He'll be there when everything else is gone. And I believe that. I could go on and on with examples of this ninth step, and I'm not going to do that to you. I'm really not. I think that basically, I want to tell you one more, and then I'll let it go. And that was my brother Terry. And, it's difficult to deal with people in your family who have the same disease. And my brother Terry had alcoholism, and God, I love Terry. Terry was the most unique member of our family. He was a genius. He's a mathematical wizard. We used to do this thing, and even a half in a bag, we would give lists of numbers, five numbers, and we would, 54,320 plus, and we would, 8 or 10 of those. And somebody would be doing it on a calculator, and Terry'd be sitting there, and when he finished, he'd give the answer before the person could push the button. He's an incredible guy. I mean, the mathematical wizard, he could do anything. He became a prize fighter. He was a good boxer. But what he was an alcoholic. And Terry deteriorated rapidly, and he ended up going places I went. He ended up going to the street, but he was the kind of guy, he wasn't like me, he was the kind of guy who would collect aluminum cans And then he'd take half the money and give it to somebody who really needed it. And he was just that kind of a guy. And I loved him a lot. And he was sober for a short period of time. He came to North Carolina, and he lived down in CC Desert before my parents moved down there. And my brother Larry was in the fellowship, and the three of us would go to meetings. It was really wonderful. But for whatever reason, that miracle that happens didn't happen for Terry. And I think it's because God didn't need him sober to do what he wanted him to do. But he went back to Ohio, and then it must have been because of the way I behaved. I must have been arrogant or something, because he would never be in town when I came home. When he saw me, he would leave. And I went for many, many years and didn't get to see him. I would briefly see him, and he'd be heading away down the alley or something. And my wife had never met him. And I hadn't seen him for many, many years. And we went back, and my parents were having their 50th wedding anniversary, and he was on my 9-step list. And he was the last brother or sister on the list. And he was there. And I said to Julia, I said, maybe Terry will be there. And she said, I really want to meet him. And I remember we met on the sidewalk. And, you know, he's an alcoholic, and he wasn't good at looking you in the eye. And, you know, I knew how he felt. You know, he had, you know, no teeth left, and he looked like he was 70 and he was 40. And Julia, of course, being an Al-Anon member, immediately fell in love with him and hugged him. And you know, and he was like hugging a board, you know, how fearful we are. And it was my parents' 50th wedding anniversary. And we had a big blowout for their 50th. And, you know, all 11 children were home, and then all the grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And my parents didn't just raise their children, they raised other children. If kids didn't have any place to go, they came to our house. It was like an assembly line at night. My mother would run the girls through the bathroom upstairs, and the boys had to go through the shower down in the basement, and we'd all get showered and everything, and then she'd wash clothes overnight so the kids could put their clean clothes on the next day. But after we all got showered, we'd all get in the living room, and there might be 15 of us or something like that, and she'd all read us either the Vision of Sir Longfellow or some, you know, Gunga Dean or something that was always exciting, and then we'd all head off to bed, and then she and my dad would come to each room and pray with us. And so they raised these kids, and they came back with their wives and their children, and there had to be 200 people there. It was an amazing thing, and everybody was there but dear Terry. And I kept looking for him, and finally he came, and oh, was he drunk. God, was he drunk. And my brothers came to me, and they said, Terry's drunk. I'm in charge of drunk in the family now. And they said, Terry's drunk. And I said, of course he's drunk. He's an alcoholic. Of course he's drunk. I said, I know what he's been doing. For the last couple hours, he's been at a bar down the street, getting up the courage to come here. I said, he must love them very much to be here. And they said, really? I said, really. And they said, great. And they took him in. And that's how I made amends to him, because they took him in. And I couldn't make direct amends because he didn't want to talk to me. But I made amends to him. And it's wonderful. And you can see the pictures from this thing. And there's Terry. About half in the bag, but he's there. And it was wonderful. About 2 years later, Terry contracted cancer. And I went up to see him, and he was in the hospital, and he couldn't run away. One of the problems about being sober when you go home is they don't leave you alone. You know, when I was drinking, they used to forget to tell me that there were reunions and things. But sober, they won't leave you alone. And I was home, and I couldn't get over to see Terry by myself. So we went to Mass Sunday morning, and I said, well, I'm headed back to North Carolina, and I snuck over to the hospital, so just Terry and I would be together. And we had about a 2-hour talk, and it's the longest we had talked in 20 years. And Terry had a lot of questions, and he knew what was happening, and he had a lot of questions, and he wanted to know a lot of things about God and about the rosaries and scapulars and all the things that are important to us growing up. And I just happened to have a few of those things on me, and we talked about things, and we had brother talk. He said, are you sure there's something after this? I said, I know there is. I know there is. He said, you think there's room for me? And I said, all you got to do is want to go there. And we made arrangements for him to do the things that needed to be done. And we talked a little bit, and I said to him, I said, "Would you mind if I hugged you?" And he said, "Well, I guess that'd be all right." And he got out of bed, and he was so frail. And this is a guy who was tough as nails. I mean, a great boxer. He couldn't have weighed 90 pounds, and he was so frail. And I put my arms around him and hugged him. And, you know, when you're a drunk, you can't hug for long. And so I only hugged him for a few seconds. But remember today we talked about God's time? In Kairos, I hugged my brother forever. And I helped him get back into bed. And I was leaving, and he said, "You know something?" He said, "I don't think I have to drink anymore." And I said, "I don't think you do either." And I got to watch this miracle happen in his life. He went home with my parents, and my sister Susan, God bless her, came down to help take care of him. And all my brothers and sisters, the same ones that didn't know how to deal with him before, were there all the time, waiting on him, kidding him, playing cards with him, joking with him, praying a rosary with him. All those things, they were all there. And he died after about 6 months, after living in great dignity as a sober man for 6 months. And one night he was sitting up in a chair praying his rosary, and he quietly closed his eyes and went home. And the funeral was a thing of joy. And I got to make amends to my brother Terry. And that's what this is about. It's about living the full life. The power of the ninth step is that for the very first time in my life, I not only belong where I am, but I have things to do where I am. God, you know, as a result of my disease, I brought chaos and insanity to my family. And as a result of the recovery and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, particularly the ninth step, I was able to bring healing to that same group of people. Now, I'm not the only one, of course. But I got to tell you, I had a hand in it. I had a hand in it. And my brothers and sisters now were so close. We had a reunion last year, and old dad is, my father, that's amazing. I just have to tell you this, and I'll leave it alone. But my father, the day after my mom was buried, he had a stroke. And everybody's saying, "Well, dad can't live without mom. He's 10 years older than she." And he said, "Dad's ready to go join her." And they all these, you know, armchair philosophers. And I said, "I don't think that's right." So they took dad, and dad's in the hospital, and they came in and they said, "You know, you have carotid artery blockage, but we can't do that because your heart's bad. We can't operate on your heart because you have a stroke." And he said, "Well, why don't you do them both?" And they said, "Mr. Lewis, you're 83 years old." He said, "Well, I got to be this way for a reason." You know? So I went up, and he had the surgery, and he came flying colors, and came through it and everything, and I talked to him. When he's in the hospital, I said to him, I said, "I was so worried. I was afraid you were going to give up." And he said, "Son," he said, "I have to live." And I said, "Why is that, Dad?" And he said, "Your mom taught me about life." And he said, "When I watched the way she died, and I watched the way she gave life to all of you, I knew that to not want to live would be an insult to her." He said, "I want to live and be around my kids and my grandkids and my great-grandkids as long as I can." He said, "I have a lot of time to join her." And he said, "We spent many years together here, and we'll spend forever together." He said, "But now my job is about life."
Well, the ninth step then is the step that allows me to live in the world. I remember saying to an old-timer one time that... I didn't think what was the value of the ninth step. And he said, "What's your philosophy about life?" And I said, "Well, it's basically do unto others and move to another state." And he said, "How would you like to live in a world where you could walk around any corner at any time and not be afraid of who you're going to run into?" And I remember I was overwhelmed by that concept, that I'd never have to worry again about who I'd run into, because my life was essentially even. I had nothing, you know, I owed no one anything in the way of amends or this or that. And he said that was the great promise. And it has been the great promise. And out of it comes tremendous miracles. I remember I served with a man one time, and he's a very important man to me, because he was one of the first men who taught me to truly believe in myself. He pulled me aside. I was a young corporal, lance corporal when I met him, and then I made corporal. And he said to me, he's a lieutenant, and he said to me, "You're one of the most talented and brightest men I've known in a long time." He said, "Why don't you go to Officer's Candidate School?" And that had been a secret dream of mine, but I didn't think a guy like me could do that. And he said, "You can." And so he taught me how to take tests. He drilled me about standing in front of the board and interviewing and all that stuff. And he really taught me the skills necessary to do these things. And so I got that appointment, and then I had that event I talked about day before yesterday about leading a patrol in a blackout down in Santo Domingo and being shot at and things like that, and not remembering any of it. And 2 months later, I was to go to Officer's Candidate School, and instead I just got out and left. And I did what I always did. I just folded my tent and took off. And I never said anything to this man. He had completed his act at the time by then, and he was on my amends list because he was an example of how I used to deal with life. I'd fold my tent and run and leave people wondering and things like that. And I remember I kept him on my list, and I kept praying to find him. And about 6-7 years ago, I was in my den. I was stretching. I was going to go for a run. And I had just finished my card thing in the morning with my ninth step people, or my eighth step cards, and just a few left at that time. And he was one of them. And I was stretching, and I just remembered a conversation we'd had aboard ship in the Mediterranean in 1964. And we were on a fantail watching the stars and things. And he said, one day I'm going to, he was a Notre Dame graduate, I'd forgotten that, and he said, "One day," he said, "I'm going to live where I can see the Golden Dome." And I picked up the phone and I called South Bend Information and I asked for his name, and he was living across the street from the university. And I called, and his wife, Sharon, answered the phone, and I said, "You wouldn't remember me," I said, "but my name is Keith Lewis." She said, "Oh, Corporal Lewis." She said, "Brian talks about you all the time." And I said, "Is he around?" And she said, "He's out for a run. He'll be right back. Please don't go anywhere." And so I waited, and he called me back. And I told him why I wanted to make amends, and that is that I had taken the gift he had given me and just disregarded it. And I told him why, and I told him I was a member, sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and things like that. And he said, "I'm so glad that you did that." He said, "Every week I would get a copy of the Navy Times," and he said, "I would hold my breath and I'd go through the L's to see if you had been killed in Vietnam." And he said, "I'm so grateful." And we talked, and I said, "Do you have any?" He asked me, "I have family," and I told him about my children. And he said, "I have children too." I said, "How are they doing?" He said, "Well, they're doing really well." And then he stopped and he said, "Just this morning," "my son came home. He got drunk and he ended up in jail last night. And just this morning he came home, and Sharon and I prayed and asked God if he would do something to help our son." And I said, "I know the name of a man who's a member of the same fellowship I am in your town. Can I give you his name and number?" And he said, "I'd really appreciate it." And I never called back. I've never found what's happened or anything else. But I know I made that amends. And I also know why it was 18 or 20 years before I could remember that he had gone to Notre Dame and one day wanted to live in South Bend, Indiana. Those are the kinds of things that happen as a result of the ninth step. And that's why when we focus and concentrate on the ninth step, it says before we're halfway through, if we're painstaking about this phase of our development, we're going to be amazed before we're halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experiences can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. Oftentimes people will say, as soon as I get over these problems, I'll see what I can do about dealing with the world around me. And I found that if I focus on my problems, that's where I always stay stuck. But if I'll go ahead and get to work on the ninth step and try to repair the damage I've done, that the world becomes a much friendlier place and most of the problems go away. I think that what we refer to as problems are a lot like my inbox. I don't know about you, but I'll let stuff stack up in my inbox for a month. Then I'll go through and I'll find it's too late for most of it anyway, so I just throw it away. And if it's truly important, I'll take care of it. But that's how I eliminate a lot of the stuff in the inbox, by just waiting and doing other things and not focusing on it and not making myself crazy with those things. And the ninth step works like that. You know, it's an amazing phenomenon, the steps, the process of getting well. It's one of the most logical things that I've ever seen in my life. And you know, logic is important. I think it's really very, very important. And I don't know if anybody here has taken courses in logic, but I know a story about a man. He's a redneck. No, he wouldn't be from around here. But I got a kick out of how people feel about their locality. Julie and I were down in South Carolina, south of Charleston, a place called Edisto Beach. They have a wonderful little conference down there. We were down there for the conference, and Julia went on a tour, and one of the ladies down there take people on tours of the plantations, and so they're going around, and Julia's always trying to find an opportunity to say something nice to people. It just astounds me. I mean, even people she doesn't like, she says nice things to, which is fine, but I don't like it when she says nice things to people I don't like. But anyway, she's on a tour, and this lady was trying so hard to make it all interesting and everything, and Julia said to her, you know, I feel fortunate. Julia was born in North Carolina. She said, I feel fortunate to have been born in the South. She said, there's a great tradition, having been born in the South. And the woman looked at her and said, oh, really? She said, well, I was born in the Deep South versus the South. So Julia said, what flashed through my mind was, oh, are you from Mississippi? But she said, I didn't say it. And I said, why would you think of something like that? And she said, I've been married to you for 10 years, so. Two rednecks decided they weren't going anywhere in life, so they should go to college to get ahead. The first one goes to see a counselor who tells him to take math, history, and logic. What's logic? The first redneck asks. The professor answered by saying, let me give you an example. Do you own a weed eater? I sure do. Then I can assume, using logic, that you have a yard, replied the professor. That's real good, says the redneck. The professor continues, logic will also tell me that since you have a yard, you also own a house. Impressed, the redneck said, amazing. And since you own a house, logic dictates that you have a wife. That's Betty May. This is incredible, the redneck said. Finally, since you have a wife, logically, I can assume that you're heterosexual, said the professor. You're absolutely right. Well, that's the most fascinating thing I ever heard. I can't wait to take that logic class. The redneck, proud of his new world opening up to him, walks back into the hallway where his friend is still waiting. So what class is y'all taking? Asked the friend. Math, history, and logic, replies the first redneck. What in tarnation is logic? Asked his friend. Let me give you an example. Do you own a weed eater? Asked the first redneck. No, his friend replied. You're homosexual, aren't you? So logic would dictate that these steps have something that's supposed to happen. There's a methodology to all of this. And it's really fascinating when you look at the first nine steps. You know, the first one finally defines the problem, doesn't it? That I'm powerless over alcohol, my life's become unmanageable. What that means is that my resources have absolutely run out. My friend Bob B. used to say, Maggie's friend used to say, we did a lot of 12-step calls together. And he'd say, I hope we didn't interrupt that man's last drunk, because he's got to finish his last drunk. And what he meant was there was a little bit of arrogance, and I can do it myself left. And of course, alcohol beats that out of us. And it was beaten out of me. And I'm convinced that plus the fact that I met you is why I hadn't taken a drink since my first meeting. The second step says that if I'm in that kind of condition, then there's got to be power someplace. And lack of power is my dilemma. And the second step tells me that in a progressive nature or fashion, I will begin to find power outside of me. And the first sense of power I had was a firm handshake and a man looking me in the eye. And then it began to expand. I remember that sense of belonging and feeling okay for a few minutes after the Lord's Prayer at the end of the meeting. And by the time I got home, I would chase it away. But I remembered that at some place there was peace and there was certainty and there was some sense of belonging. And so I would be back at the meeting the first opportunity the next day, and I would re-experience that, you know. Then I found that I could experience that power with a phone call. And then I remember one time I was riding to a meeting with my... And I found the great secret of Alcoholics Anonymous. It may separate us from every other form of recovery. I was on the way to a meeting with my sponsor, and I said to him... I was angry, because I was angry at everything. And I had a line of things to be angry about. And I just said to him, I said, "When am I going to stop being a newcomer?" And he always gave me these smart aleck answers. He said, "When you stop getting angry every time they say newcomer, you know." I remember, so I ground. And we went to the meeting, and the following week we're going to the same meeting. And I said to him, "I hope Bill's there." And he said, "Who's Bill?" I said, "Bill's the new guy who came last week." I said, "Every morning when I prayed and asked God to keep me sober and to keep you sober, I asked him to keep Bill sober too." And Dan looked at me and smiled, and he said, "You're no longer a newcomer." And I found that the great strength and the growth and the power comes from being concerned about another human being. And it surprised me that I was concerned about another human being. That wasn't my way. You know, when you're selfish and self-centered to the extreme, being concerned about another newcomer isn't my way. I would be concerned if too many people came and there wouldn't be any coffee left for me. You know, something like that, something deeply spiritual. But here I am concerned about the welfare of another human being, and it amazed me. And of course, as we grow in this program and in the third step, we entertain the fact that there's a power greater than ourselves. And not only that he loves me enough to see me get well, that he has my best interests at heart. I have a good friend, Mike W., who sort of hand-fed me back to a belief in a higher power I grew up with. I said to him, I said, "You really believe..." I was sober about a year or something, and I said, "Do you really believe God loves you?" And he said, he was going through some difficult times and handling them beautifully. I said, "Do you really believe God loves you?" He said, "Yeah, I do." And I said, "How much?" And he had a crucifix on his wall, and he pointed to it, and he said, "This much." And it overwhelmed me. It shut me up, which was a difficult thing to do. And I didn't want to agree with him, but I was impressed with what he believed. And the second and third step really taught me that what kept me sober in the beginning wasn't the fact that I thought it would work for me, but the fact that you thought it would work for me. And I'd call my sponsor and say, "Oh," I'd say, he'd say, "Hello," I'd say, "Are you sure?" He'd say, "I'm positive." I'd say, "Okay," and hang up. That's all it took. If he believed I could do it, I could do it. And then one day I believed I could do it. And I believed because you did. And you said things like, "You can't miss. If you do what we do, you can't miss." And I began to believe that was true. And then, of course, the fourth step begins with that house cleaning. And the fourth step is not possible without the third step. The third step is what gives me the courage to look and do the fearless and searching moral inventory. And then, of course, the fifth step is where I share with God, myself, and another human being the exact nature of my wrong. And the sixth step is where I find a great spiritual truth that of myself I'm nothing. I can't change me. All the wanting in the world can't change me. But the seventh step, which is so beautifully done in the manuscript, where it says, "Humbly on our knees, ask God to remove these defects of character, holding back nothing." And you know, with some of my defects of character, some of the things that were in my way were so devastating to me, year in and year out, and so deteriorated my spirit that one day on my knees I begged to be changed. And I'd like to take a minute here to talk a little bit about relationships. I know that when I'm in a discussion meeting and somebody says, does anybody have a problem? And somebody puts up their hand, and if it's not mother had a square nipple, then it has to do with relationships. And so I'm frightened when I hear somebody say that. But I just want to give you an example of how these defects of character can be taken away. I always tried to solve my own problem. And one problem that I experienced a lot as an isolated guy was the problem of lack of intimacy and loneliness. I don't mean friends. I had a lot of friends, and I could always get a foursome for a game of golf, and I had buddies and things like that. But what I didn't have was an intimate relationship, and the reason I didn't was because I did it all wrong. You know, I tried to start my interpersonal relationships at the end and work to the beginning. I tried to start off satisfying my sexual drives and then work toward friendship somehow. And I always ended up in relationships that were selfish and self-centered and mutually destructive. And and after about 12 or 13 years of so-called, well, I was sober in a lot of ways. And I banged my head against this problem for such a long time. And I was leaving Alabama to go back to North Carolina, and I was up there visiting, and I stayed at my friend's house, at Bob Brown's house. He had a wonderful little house on a fourth tee at this golf course, and it was a little two-bedroom place, so whichever one of his friends, he never locked it. When he bought the house, he threw the keys away. Went out on the balcony and threw the keys away. And he said, God gave me this house, I'm not going to lock it. And people, he'd be on vacation, and people would go out there and stay there and do their fourth steps and things like that. And he'd come home, there'd be three or four people, the coffee would be going to be three or four people on the deck looking out into the woods, writing and things like that. I got there and I went in the guest room, and I was in anguish. I had terminated another one of those relationships where we competed and beat each other up, did all that dumb stuff that self-centered, selfish people do, and I just had it. And I got on my knees and I told God, I said, I'm gonna pray till I get this resolved. I said, I can't live like this anymore. And humbly on my knees, I begged him to remove this defect of character. And I prayed all night. And my friend Dick Corcoran, who's since passed away, came in after me, so he had to sleep on the sofa. He missed the bedroom by 5 minutes, but he knew something was going on, and we were close friends. And he prayed most of the night, too. And I can tell you, it was the night of July the 4th, 1985, because what I concluded the next morning was I told God, I said, I'm never going to abuse my friendship with another female again with your help. I said, with your help, I'll never do anything that I feel guilty about the next day again. And I said, I'm going to live a celibate life. I'm going to take all my energy and focus on helping people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I ever have a companion or a partner, it will be because you pick them and not because I pick them. And the next time, I'm going to let somebody else tell me how to do this because I don't know how to do it. And that night, I went to a meeting Bob Brown was speaking at, a meeting I didn't want to go to, but I went to, and I met the woman I later married. And I felt, in love with her immediately. And I called my sponsor and said, the one thing I know is that I don't know anything about being with another human being. I don't know how to be in a relationship without competing. I don't know how to do these things. Will you help me? And he said, I'll help you if you do everything I tell you to do. I said, it's done. And so I kept him up on everything. And finally I said to him one day, I went to him, I said, Julian, I have decided, after about 2 months, I said, Julian, I have decided to make this an exclusive relationship. He said, no, you can't do that. And I said, but there's nobody else I want, and I love her, and I'm going on and on. And he said, I'm telling you, Keith, don't do that. He said, you have a lot of friends in the program or a woman. He said, start treating them like friends. And so friends of mine and I would go to dinner, we'd go to a movie, and just be friends. And he said, you're not ready for an exclusive relationship. And he said, one day you'll know why. And I just took him at his word and did what he said. And about 6 months later, I went to him and I said, you know, Tom, what I've always done is if I find that I care for someone, then my first thought is if they could pick anybody or me, they'd pick the other person. And so what I do is I try to tie them into an interpersonal or exclusive relationship before I'm ready, for fear that they'll find somebody else and I'll lose. And I said, and then I end up resenting the fact that I feel trapped. And he said, very good, very good. He said, you're now 17 years old. And And so then he said, now it's okay. So Julia and I then began our exclusive relationship. And then one day I said to him, I said, you know, we're going to get married. He said, whoa, wait a minute. He said, what happened to engagement? I said, that's an old-fashioned idea. He said, well, it got to be that way for a reason, Keith. And he said, I want you to be engaged. And I said, okay. So I bought a ring and I got all ready. And it was Christmas Eve. And I had a fire going in the fireplace. And Julia came over to my place. We were going to go to midnight mass together and then open gifts under the tree at my house. And I was dressed up and I had asked her parents for permission to marry their daughter. Her mother said, oh, I think that'd be wonderful. And her father said, go for it. I had this all figured out. I was nervous as I could be, but I had practiced and things like that, and it just fell apart like a cheap suit. I was just about ready to go into my act, and she said, excuse me, I want to powder my nose, and she went in the bathroom. Well, once you get started, you can't stop. So I chased her in the bathroom, and I put the ring on the wrong finger, the wrong hand, and asked her if she'd marry me, and she just fell into my arms, just sobbed, and we went off to mass together that night, and whenever we looked at each other, we just cried, and it was just an incredible thing. And I found that being engaged is different than an exclusive relationship. I found myself doing strange things, like getting out my date book and saying, look, I just wanted you to know that I've agreed to do this conference, and I'm going to be going to, you know, to new work here, and everything else, and you know, if there's anything you have planned, please tell me so I can put it down now before all the weekends fill up. And I began allowing another human being to have a say in my life. And it's, even married, I'd always protected all of that. It's none of your business. You live your life, I have mine, and, you know, all that nonsense. And 50-50, which, of course, is the worst thing that can happen to a marriage, is attempting 50-50, because whenever I looked at it, it looked awfully lopsided on her side to me, whenever, you know. And she thought it was lopsided the other way. And I want to give 100%, and so does my wife, and that's why I think it works. And then I, error number 14, I went to Tom and I said, wonderful thing. I said, God's hand's really in this relationship. He said, I know it is. And I said, I tell you what happened just yesterday. I said, Julia has an opportunity to transfer her job over to my town now, you know. And I said, so we're going to live together until it's time to get married. He said, no. And I said, why not? And he said, look, he said, you've done it all right. He said, why do you want to enter into a way of living which violates your principles now? He said, that's number one. He said, number two, he said, you're a long-term member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, people watch you, and they watch what you do. They watch how you carry yourself. They watch how you conduct yourself. He said, you've even stopped cursing on a golf course because people know you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, why would you want to do something like this and jeopardize everything at this late date? And of course he was right, and I went back and told Julia that, and you know how it works. You know, we were married 4 or 5 months later, and I carried her across the threshold, my wife. It was an incredible experience, and 3 days later she was able to transfer her job to my town. And what I'm saying is that the seventh step made me realize that I didn't know anything about how to do it myself, and I desperately needed God in this thing. Then we get to the tenth step, the tenth step is that marvelous step that says, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. And the big book says, every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into our activities. How best can I serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These thoughts must go with us constantly. Now, the reason these thoughts can go with us constantly is because I'm no longer trying to run the show to suit myself. You know, I'm no longer focusing on what's wrong and what I want and all the rest of it. My focus now is outward. Remember what Father Powell told me? He said, first you discover who you are, then you fully accept who you are, and then you forget who you are. And self-forgetting is a key to peace and serenity, because the view is always outside. When I was newly sober, my sponsor made me go talk to one of the old guys who brought Alcoholics Anonymous to Washington, D.C. And he was on his deathbed. And he made me go talk to him. I didn't want to go talk to some old guy, and I didn't want to go to talk to some old guy who was dead. I mean, he's going to die pretty soon. What good was he to me? You know, he couldn't help me get a job or anything like that. And But I did it because my sponsor made me do it. And I went over and I sat down and I talked to this man. And I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed talking to him. And it wasn't until later, you know how you go back and you think about what happened? It occurred to me that out of 3 hours, we spent 2 hours and 50 minutes talking about me and 10 minutes talking about him. He was so excited that this kid had found Alcoholics Anonymous when he was 29 years of age. He was so excited that I had a sponsor and that I had a home group. And I mean, it was the biggest thing of him to him that day. And it was a man who was near death. And I thought, if I'd have been the one near death, I would have wanted to be doing all the talking and all the whining, and I would have wanted it to be about me. But it wasn't. It was about others, because here was a man who had truly forgotten himself, who had truly found the key to the spiritual existence. And what was happening to him was just fine, and it wasn't important. What was happening to me was important. And I discovered something about people who work the steps and live this program. He had forgotten who he was. Comes the acid test. Can we stay sober and keep emotional balance and live to good purpose under all conditions? You know, there have been a lot of attempts at helping alcoholics, and some of them have been like therapeutic communities where you go live together and you call each other names and beat each other up and do all that stuff and scare each other and you cannot drink together. But what good is that? Because you can't leave there. You can't leave there without being filled with fear and trepidation and anger at the world and all the rest of it. Alcoholics Anonymous is just the opposite. When I went to that little treatment center, they asked me, what is it that you want? And I said, I just want to go to a, I want to be put someplace where I won't hurt myself or anybody I love anymore. And they said, you can't do that. If you're going to be well, you can't hide out. You can't hide out in a treatment center. You can't even hide out in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're going to be well, you have to live in the world, and you have to live in the world to good purpose. How does that happen? It happens through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a lot like breaking a bone, you know. It's a very, very traumatic and difficult thing. But when the bone heals, it's stronger there than at any other point. And I think that's what happens in these 12 steps. It becomes strong. And it's in the 10th step where we observe and watch what happens. It's in the 10th step where we make judgments about not ourselves, because our will and our life is no longer any of our business, God's business. We made that decision back in the 3rd step. But it's in the 10th step where on a day-to-day basis I see how I live my life and whether or not I do His will. Even whether I'm using the character defects I found in the 7th step to His benefit, to His good. And this is also where I see people overcome exception and extreme difficulties in their lives. You know what happened to me? I think there are times in our sobriety that we're trying, or times when we move to the next level, if we're prepared. One of the things that that happened to me, I was sober about 6 years, and a little over 6 years, and I was one of those unfortunate people who got everything he said he'd need to be happy. I had the house with the hardwood floors, and I was a skinny young fellow. I was running marathons. I had a very, very active social life, and I knew that's what I always wanted. And I had season tickets to the symphony and to Folgers Theater and on. I had all these things that I knew you need to be happy. And I had come to realize just how miserable I was. And I was into self-aggrandizement. I had to be noticed. On. My ego was just totally out of control. And I had a job I loved very much, and I had a bunch of people who worked for me, and I always worried about something might happen to these people. So I set up a system within our organization that if anybody began to get into trouble, we could all sit down and tell that person that. And most of us were recovering people, so that was the agreement. If you work here, you have to be willing to have someone tell you what they see if they see something that concerns them. And I was just being wonderful and brilliant and miserable. I was waking up in the middle of the night. I just had all sorts of problems. I was running, I just run further and faster and lose more weight. And I was just nuts, just complete out of my mind. And one day I walked into work, and all those ingrates who worked for me were sitting in a room with yellow pads, number 2 pencils. they asked me if I'd sit down and listen to some of their concerns, and they began to talk about some of the things I'd been doing and how I couldn't be wrong, and I treated them all like they were stupid and they didn't know anything. I was the only person who knew anything, and on and on and on and on. And it got around to a dear friend of mine who was my administrative assistant, and she I knew loved me. I mean, I knew they all cared about me, but I knew that this woman loved me. We were dear and close friends. And she began to cry, and she said something that terrified me. She said, "You know, Keith," she said, "every lunchtime you go to an AA meeting," which I did, it was down right down the street. And she said, "You used to come back all excited and tell me something you'd heard." And she said, "For the last month you've been coming back telling me something you said." And I knew that was wrong. And so I called my sponsor, who agreed that I had not been on my game of late. And I won't go into details, but I had begun to violate values and spiritual principles and stuff that I never could have imagined I would do. And if I wasn't doing it, I wanted to. And my life was completely out of control. I was seriously depressed. And you'd have to ask this question, you know, come time when can we stay sober and in emotional balance and to good living lives to good purpose under all conditions? And I had clearly lost it. And I went to a friend of mine who was a psychiatrist, and he's a dear friend. And he sat down, and I told him honestly what had been going on with me. And he said, "I'm really worried about you." And I said, "What do I do?" And he said, "I want you to go to this place down in Texas." He said, "It's a hospital." And he said, "I don't know what's wrong with you, but whatever else you need, you need to be loved." And so I agreed with my sponsor. I'd do whatever I was told to do. And so I didn't want to, but I got on the plane. And I'm sober six and a half years, and I know my life's over. I know that professionally I'm ruined. Nobody's going to ask me to speak at an AA conference anymore. I just know my life's over, you know. And I'm trying to figure out which state I'll move to start all over. And I got down there, and I ran into a guy named David A., and David A. just put his arm around me. David Aronofsky's dead now. And down in Texas, you give your sobriety date, and when I introduced myself, I gave my sobriety date, but I couldn't remember the year that I got sober. And I just started to cry, and he came over and put his arm around me, and he said, "All that matters is that you don't drink, and you're going to be okay." And that's the shape I was in. I was just an absolute emotional wreck. And it was sort of funny on the way down there. Anybody remember Braniff Airlines? You know, Braniff Airlines had these airplanes, and they painted them all these wild colors, you know. So my life's over, and I'm on a pink jet flying to Dallas, Texas. And I get off there, and a man met me, and he took me to this hospital. It was about 11 o'clock at night when I got in there. And so the next morning, my roommate assumed, it was a treatment center, and my roommate assumed that I was a new drunk that just came in the night before. And I was so depressed I couldn't get out of bed. And he came over, he said, "Hey, buddy," he said, "you better get out of bed." He said, "That nurse here is a real pain in the neck." And she said, "She'll come in here and she'll be carrying on. You better get out of that bed." And I said, "I can't." He said, "I'll help you, partner." So he's a big Texan, so he helps me out of bed, and he's putting my shirt on, and we get one arm in his shirt. And he said, "I know how you feel." He said, "I felt like this." He said, I came in here 6 days ago." He said, "I feel a lot better now." He said, "How long are you sober?" I said, 6 and a half years. He said, "Oh, shit," you know. And he went over and got in bed, and I laid back down. And it was horrendous. And I went back, and I did the first 5 steps again, and I did them as thoroughly as I could. I did 6 and 7, and I gave God my professional life, and I gave him all my belongings. And I began then a practice which I've carried now for over 20 years. And frequently I'll sit down and I'll give God back all the things he's given me and tell him that I only want what he wants me to use today. But then I had to look at the 8th and 9th step, and my arrogance and my self-centeredness and my pride had damaged a lot of people, and I ended up writing letters of amends to everybody who worked for me and told them this is just the beginning. And I wanted to leave my profession. I wanted to leave the state. You know, I was toying with the idea of leaving the country. I mean, I was just mortified, and I knew I couldn't do that. And my sponsor said, "Come back for 90 days and then do whatever you want to do."
And so I went back for 90 days, and of course I was loved and accepted, and I'm still doing what I was doing. And, but I like to tell that story because it's imperative that we understand that life happens to us, and character defects get in the way. And if we're around people who love us and care about us, they say those things. I'm a bit of a strong personality, I've been told by a few people. My ex-wife and her lawyer, for one. But seriously, so what I do is I make it a practice to find a few strong people around me. And I say to them, if you ever see me doing anything out of line, if you ever see me doing anything that violates the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous or good sober living, please tell me. You know, you have carte blanche in my life. Not just my sponsor, my friends, the people who watch me day to day. And I remember I did this, and one of them, I always try to make one of them a woman, because women see things in me that men don't see. And one woman, her name was Nancy, tougher than nails, Nurse Nancy, we called her. And so I, you know, one day I bump into this little honey who moved into town, and she was sober long enough. I mean, she was sicker than hell, but she was sober long enough, and right away the old Keith comes out, and Nancy's watching all this stuff, and after the meeting she said, I want to talk to you. I said, I don't want to talk to you. And she said, I've got permission to say anything I want to. I said, I withdraw the permission. She said, you told me it was for life and it couldn't be withdrawn. I said, leave me alone. So the next day I get a telegram. Dear Keith, stop. You're being a jerk. Stop. Love, Nancy. And I caught her up, and she said, what on earth are you doing? I said, I know. It's wrong. I won't, honestly. And I didn't. And I always surround myself with people like that, and I ask a few specifically to have that freedom in my life. And of course, the other thing I do is I tell everything to my sponsor. I tell everything to my sponsor. We call getting current. And we get off and have lunch or play some golf or do something. But we sit down together and get current. And I tell them what's going on. And more importantly, I tell them what I think my motives are for why I'm doing what I'm doing. You know, it's not sufficient, the 10th step tells me, it's not sufficient to do what's right. The road's narrowing. I must do what's right for the right reason. And that's the critical aspect of this thing. And that's the value of my sponsor. And that's why having a sponsor who's living a life the way you want to live your life is critically important. I want to be like my sponsor. I'd give anything to be like my sponsor. He's everything that I want to be as a sober man. And so I want him helping me determine. And I've been in and out of a lot of little scrapes and things like that. And he's always there and giving me sage advice or suggestions. And then he always sees that I take definitive action. And he always gives good sage. But we stay current. And the other thing I do when I get with him and get current is I discuss every guy I'm sponsoring. And what I'm doing, and do you see anything or any input or any this or any of that, you know. And he gives me invaluable advice on how to sponsor and what to do. I consider being a sponsor an extremely responsible position. I'm not responsible for the person drinking or this or that. I don't mean that. But I'm responsible that I be available to the best of my ability, that I be present when they're talking, that I say the things that are difficult to say when they need to be said, and I need to know what my motives are. Some people, I think that I know some guys who must have been kicked around and beat up at the schoolyard when they were kids, because boy, when a sick human being comes to them and asks them to help them, they feel that it's their turn now, and they beat this person up. And I'm very, very careful not to do that. Do you have something? Well, I just see it as a responsibility, you know. I'm available to them, and I try to be present to them when we're together. I don't lay down rules like you call me, I'll never call you. Well, that's the dumbest thing in the world. What if God says you better call me, and I say I can't? I got some pride, you know. I mean, you got to have standards, God. So I'm not going to call him. That's crazy, isn't it? I mean, if it crosses my mind, I'm going to shower or something like that and say, you better call so and so. I pick up the phone and I call him. I mean, otherwise the 11th step's wrong when it says an intuitive thought or a notion. Now it's wrong. I mean, it's a relationship. I'm not an easy guy to get to know. I mean, one of the things I know is that the guys who I sponsor tell other people things before they tell me. And it takes a long, long time for people, I think they see me as severe or something. I mean, that's all I can figure, is they see me as severe. Because they're really hesitant about telling me things, you know. And I recognize that, you know. So what I try to do is I try very hard to make it easier for them to do that. Mike and I, it's really funny, the guys that Mike sponsors, Mike and I we're prayer partners. We decided almost 26 years ago that every day we're going to pray for each other. And then we have prayer lists and we exchange them. So every day he prays for the guys I sponsor, I pray for the guys he sponsors, things like that. And often the people will call Mike up and tell him something because they don't want to tell me. You know, and Mike will always say, well, that's very interesting. You know, you probably ought to get around to tell Keith something. I'm not telling him. Well, okay, I won't tell him, but you really might want to get around to tell him. Of course, in a few weeks, they're telling me. Well, you know, a couple of days ago, a guy who Mike sponsored sat down and said, I got to tell you something. I don't want to tell Mike. And so, it goes back and forth. The other thing that I make sure they understand is that my sponsor's available to them. And, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, I had a phone conversation with Tom and his sponsor and his sponsor. And they told me, we've decided that in June you're going to come to Saskatchewan, Canada. You know, and well, okay, I'll be there. But it's really fun. I mean, it's nice. One time we got together, there were 8 generations of us. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, the Cecil's sponsor has 49 or 50 years, something like that. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was with a kid I'd been sponsoring who had 3 weeks. And he couldn't believe it, you know. And he said to me, he said, everybody in AA is old. I said, yeah, we are. I said, old's a great goal for a guy your age in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. So the 11th step in sponsorship, or the 10th step in sponsorship and all that. And what I really want to get across with this is that many of us also like the experience of an occasional retreat from the outside world where we can quiet down for an undisturbed day or so of self-overhauling and meditation. Part of what I like to do as part of my 10th step, and I'd already talked to a couple of folks about this, is silent retreats. Silent retreats. Now, retreats like this are certainly fine, but silent retreats are also very nice. And I like to go off and do the things that I do for spiritual sustenance, but most of all, just be quiet and be with God. And I find that I stop preparing myself, as I was saying before, to meet the world when I'm in a silent retreat. It's amazing when normally, if somebody's walking toward me on a sidewalk, I prepare myself in case they say something. You know, well, when you go to a silent retreat, you realize you don't need to do that because nobody's going to be saying anything and neither are you. And so you really then get peaceful and quiet inside. And I think that's very, very important. Again, people have been doing that for thousands of years, and there's a reason. You know, it's because it works. I remember one time I was very pleased, and I went to Sandy. He's my sponsor, and I went to him and said, Sandy, I said something wrong. I insulted somebody, and I immediately stopped, and I apologized, and I offered to make amends. And I'm really proud of myself. Because in the old days, I'd have sat around for 3 weeks coming up with good reasons for why I was right to do it. And so this time I just stopped. I said, I'm wrong, and I apologize. And he said, I'm really proud of you. He said, that's the second best way to have done that. And I said, oh, really? He said, yeah, the best way is to not do it in the first place. And I remember, what a concept. You know, what a concept. You know, pass up the opportunity to hurt someone's feelings, even if you get a laugh out of it. And I think that's what the 10th step, one of the things the 10th steps help me do, is you recognize that there are other people in the world. Now, it sounds silly, but there are really other people in the world. And not only are they in the world, they are not there for my enjoyment. They aren't there for me to ridicule and kid. You know, they aren't there for me to use. They aren't there for me to entertain. You know, they're there because God has a purpose for them. And so what the 10th step has helped me to understand is that I'm a traveler among travelers. I'm a fellow among fellows. You know, I'm on a journey and you're on a journey. And your journey is every bit as important as my journey. And that I'm just one of many.